Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me.
That is the voice of Nina Simone. My voice is the voice of Rick Hogan. I'm filling in for Bill and Wendy today and tomorrow and trying something a little unusual, the long-form interview. I could not have a better guest in here to attempt this experiment in contemporary radio than my old laughing friend, dear friend, and my only priest friend, it turns out. You know, I have a lot of friends who do a lot of things. Father John Cusick, I have newspaper friends and barroom friends. You are my only priest friend. Is that, how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm just honored. I represent the entire ordained ministry around the world.
Hi, John.
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
Merry Christmas.
I'm well. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Let me ask you this Merry Christmas stuff. I'm a half Russian Jew and half Irish Catholic, and I have never ever found a Jew who is offended when I say Merry Christmas. Have you?
Nor do I. Nor, and amazingly, the number of Jewish people who will wish me a Merry Christmas because they know it's my holiday.
Right.
You know?
Well, why is that a to-do these days, do you think? I mean, is political correctness gone crazy?
So. Yeah, but I think it's starting to melt
a little bit.
Yeah, except in retail. I've noticed in retail that if you...
Happy holidays. Yes.
If somebody wishes you a Merry... something I read the other day. A checkout somebody or other at some store wished a patron Merry Christmas, and the person just ripped right at him.
Ugh.
You should not be telling me that. You know, it's happy holidays. You don't know what... I'm thinking, take a deep breath, honey.
Really? Really? You have been doing... I have often thought, having read some of John's... work for the church, sermons and whatever else those things are called. Forgive my lack of knowledge on, not you, John, but listeners too, on what goes on in church. I don't go to church often. I have been enough, but I have read what John writes. I am telling you, people, I'm going to read some excerpts of some of the stuff he's recently written on Facebook. Facebook, you said, just in the lobby, has kind of become your new pulpit.
Yes, since I retired. I retired in July of 14. And
why did you retire? Not all the strum and drawing, but you had reached a certain age.
Yeah. You know, I was a little bit shy of 70, and that's the retirement age. But I retired for a strange reason, though, Rick. My dad died at 59 of lung cancer, and he never had an opportunity to retire. Mm. And I said to myself and to the God in whom I believe, if I can live long enough and healthy enough, I want to take a period of time in my life in his name. Mm. And so I retired earlier than I probably should have, but best decision I ever made.
What'd your dad do?
Worked for the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Railroad Company.
And you were, as you've often said, from the wrong side of the tracks.
Yes,
in
literally.
The Beverly neighborhood.
Right. I had literally crossed the tracks to go sign up to caddy at BCC.
The smallest caddy, yep. lightweight caddy,
but I had guts and courage.
You did. You did. You were an only child.
Right. The best and the worst.
Your parents, one of the highlights of your recent postings on Facebook is your memory of and affection for your parents.
Yes, at Christmas. I wrote a lot about that this year.
Talk about my favorite Christmas tree story of all time is Mike Royko's sort of made up but maybe real about two poor people.
Oh, Joe and Mary, tree. The ugliest tree in the world.
The ugliest tree in the world, and how if you took two ugly trees and smushed them together, you'd have a beautiful tree just like people. Your Christmas tree story is fantastic. I'd never heard it before. What is it?
Well, getting the Christmas tree was the annual best test of whether the marriage could survive another year. And the three of us got in the car, and we went out to Crescent Landscaping at 105th or 107th in Western. And we get out, and my mother's in charge of this because that's the German side in her. So we march up and down every Christmas tree aisle. She'll say, how about you lift that one up? So we're holding the darn tree out, and then you got to turn it to make sure it's... And we finish, and we walk back to the curb where the car was parked, and my mother makes the announcement, they don't have any good ones. To which my father, counting to 10, turned around, and with that wry sense of almost satire in his life, looks at all the trees and said, Florence, the man must have 1,000 Christmas trees. You mean he has 1,000 bad trees. At which he got in the car, would not get out again, drove to the next place.
Yeah, he was like your chauffeur that
yeah,
day,
then he was the taxi driver. And then, of course, I got the wrath from my mother. Oh, you're dead. But it comes back every year, you know. You mean he has 1,000 bad trees.
It must be difficult in this piece that was posted a few days ago. And again, you can just look up John Cusick on Facebook, C-U-S-I-C-K. You have an artificial tree.
Yes.
Has that been a long time thing for? Did this sort of in its way, John, kind of scar you and make it impossible for you to go find a real perfect tree?
No, I think I was much more into safety.
Oh, you interesting. Know,
when there was somebody, like when my parents were alive and living at home, there was someone in the house. But I think after a while you get concerned, even in this day and age of fire and all different kind of things. And it's also more convenient, you know, just pull it out of a box. But
how long does it take you to put it together?
The better part of a half a day.
Yeah. And is that that's a joyful thing for
it's huge.
I imagine.
What I've done with it is it's a retro tree. All the ornaments are ancient. They're from my house after my parents died, and then my Aunt May and her sisters. And so all the ornaments, it's just an honor to put them up there that they've been hanging on Christmas trees probably for 70, 80 years.
Wow. And each one has meaning for you.
Yeah, then. It does. Yeah, it does.
The tree, too, you write in, and I'm going to quote from John's Facebook postings over the last few days. I've been on John for some years now to put together his thoughts in a book, and I hope he does that because his recent post would fit perfectly, almost without editing, in a book. You say three of the three important religious symbols of Christmas surround your tree.
You have a star, you have the tree, and then you have the creche, the nativity set, whatever you want to call it. Of the three, I think the one that is really the most significant for me is really, believe it or not, the tree itself, because, I mean, it comes out of a Germanic background that it's one of the only things in nature that does not change in the course of a year. It's evergreen.
Mm.
And so there's a sense, I think, in terms of religious symbolism, that there's a presence that is with us, doesn't change summer, fall, winter, spring. And I think the Christmas story reminds us of that. And the star in Matthew's gospel, these gentle persons who come from the east follow a star. And so the star is in the heavens, and the birth of the child is on the bottom, and it's evergreen between the two.
In other words, ladies and gentlemen, go take a good long look at your Christmas tree. We'll take a little break. You can see why I want John Cusick on for the whole hour. I am. This is Rick Hogan filling in for Bill and Wendy, spending this entire hour, what's left of it, with Father John Cusick, formerly of Old St. Pat's. We just talked about Christmas trees, and I'm trying to tell you to go to Facebook sometime today and read his recent, you can read all his posts, but his recent posts that have been about Christmas and about church and about religion and about the world are just astonishing. John, what is it, little kid from the wrong side of the tracks in Beverly, what is it that brought you to religion? I've always been curious about that.
Well, you know, there was a thing, Rick, in Chicago, it was called cultural Catholicism. You know, the whole neighborhood was Catholic.
Sure.
And it was a very important thing in our family. I don't, you know, my dad wouldn't ever consider himself a religious person, I don't think, but he went to Mass every Sunday. And
the whole neighborhood, I assume, or the bulk of the neighborhood.
The whole neighborhood was Catholic. I mean, come on.
And they went to Mass. The interesting thing is being Catholic and going to Mass, it's not always the same thing.
No, it's not at all. In the 45 years I've been a Catholic priest, if you run into somebody and they say, what do you do for a living? I say, well, I'm a priest. Well, gee, Father, I didn't go to church Sunday. Well, I said, I didn't ask, but I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah.
But going to church really defines, for a lot of people, their Catholicism.
Does it reaffirm it?
I'm not sure what it does for a lot of people. All I know is I've never been one ever to judge anybody.
No kidding. How else could we be friends?
I work under the adage, and I think it's the only thing that has driven me. Here comes everybody. And then secondly, something my father taught me in a saloon. Imagine that. Never be ordinary if you ever have the opportunity to be someone special. And special never meant power, fame, or money. I mean, that was never in
right,
our cards. But
right.
it's go the extra mile. You know, don't be dull. Don't look around and say, how's everyone else doing? And figure out what's best for you and do it.
And these days, don't spend all your time staring at an iPhone either.
No, you go out for dinner. I'm sure, you know, you see this, Rick, when you go out for dinner, you see these young people sitting there. There's five people at a table, and there's five little machines going and thinking, why are you here?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things is that's the definition of dull when you're with other people and you are more consumed with your latest email or text.
But see, I think what's changed, and I wrote something on this on some other forum, is the concept of a family meal has really been trashed. And we had a family meal at least once a week, and oftentimes it consists of three of us. My dad would come home from work. He had his place. Mom had her place. I had my, and we waited till Dad came home, and we ate.
Mm. And you talked.
Exactly. And listened to WGN. It was the
this
radio.
This is, I must say, because you're on WGN, John knows more about WGN than Jimmy DeCastro, who runs the station.
I mean,
you listen. You're a loyal listener.
I thought today coming down the train from Wisconsin that I think I remember that Wally Phillips started in the afternoons. I could be wrong.
Well, no one here would be able to
tell
you. No,
but I mean, I'm 70 years old, and it was always on.
Yeah.
I mean, there was only one station, you know. And I grew up with it, and all the people who are on the station, they're like your relatives. You know more about them. I mean, it's a wonderful experience.
Yeah, it's rare.
Yeah, it's family.
It's unique in
it
this
is.
Country.
Yeah,
I
so
think.
It's not a radio station. It's connected to this thing called Chicago. And now with the internet, I mean, because I travel quite a bit, I can tap on WGN.com and I can pick up whatever I need to do wherever I'm at in the country.
You're the kind of listener we need.
Oh,
the kind of listener we need. Was there any pressure? Your folks never said, hey, son, when you started to say, you know, when you're eight and want to be a cowboy or a fireman,
no,
they said.
They never. My father was a backhanded compliment. When I was in the seminary, he said, John, if you ever want to leave, that's okay.
He was a realist.
You know, but he wanted to make sure he knew that there was no pressure from them because, I mean, we all knew growing up that there were pushy parents that pushed, you know, not only their sons maybe towards the Catholic priesthood, but they pushed them into all kinds of careers.
Sure.
They most likely never wanted.
Yeah.
You know.
What is it that got you in the seminary?
It was the priest in the parish.
Yeah.
And since I've seen you last, I buried my probably my oldest hero.
Wow.
He was 90-some years old, and it was in his will that I would preach his funeral. And he called me one day, years ago, and he had a big Irish family. And he called me and he said, John, this is Father so-and-so. And he said, I just buried one of my brothers yesterday, and it dawns on me that I'm not going to live forever. So I'm calling with a question. And I said, Father, before you go any further, something I've never told you. You're the reason I went into Quigley, which was the high school seminary.
Sure.
And he said, well, you know, it's funny you say that because I always thought so, and that's the reason for my call.
Ugh.
I want to know if you would preach my funeral because I want to be remembered for at least doing one thing right.
Oh, wow.
Rick, my heart just, I'll never forget that line. I want to be remembered for doing at least one thing right.
That must be among the most
it was one of the
praiseful things you've ever heard.
Most powerful things I've ever heard, you know. And so there I was, you know, 70, so that would be 60 years later, standing at the end of his casket.
How emotional was that funeral for you? You have spoken at...
It was for me because, you know, I was a starry-eyed kid, and this guy you looked up to, and the priests in our parish. I grew up at Little Flower at 80th and Wood. They were all great men, and I was what you'd call a church rat. You know, I would serve Mass. I'd be over there all the time. Whatever you need, I'm there, you know. And so it just got ingrained in me, and I probably in the back of my head said, hey, maybe I can do that someday, you know, and here
well,
I sit.
And the fact that he was that proud of you is, it's terribly moving to me at this point.
You know, but the fun thing in those days, and I think we all had. Yeah. But I think the adult world all got the same cassette. If they were proud of you, they didn't show it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like parents. You know
yeah,
that.
You're right.
You know, there's nobody giving you an attaboy.
You're right.
There's, oh, Rick, you know, boy, you're the best kid somebody could have. You know, I can imagine Herman Cogan saying that.
No, he didn't.
You know,
no, he didn't.
But it's true. I mean, all of our parents, that was just, well, we don't want it to go to their head. How many times did we hear that?
Sure.
But they had their own way of I think, supporting us, you know. But it wasn't with words.
Your dad did get to see you preach.
Yep. I was ordained in May of 1970. He died in September of 71. So,
what was that like for you?
Hardest thing. I had to preach his funeral. I know nobody's going to talk for nobody's going to talk for my old man but me.
Yeah.
You know. And so what I did is I went into a mind freeze. I said, I had no idea what I said, but a friend of mine who was there took detailed notes and said, "We're going to go out for dinner soon. I'll tell you what you said." But I had to do that, and I did the same for my mother. The three most difficult talks I've ever given in my life were the burial of my father, my mother, and the third, believe it or not, Andrew Greeley.
Right.
Who, the most significant name in American Catholicism, and he said, "I want you to preach my funeral." And those were the three toughest.
I know you take those requests humbly, and it is an incredible responsibility when you write those eulogies. What kind of pressure do you feel?
Well, first of all, I don't write anything out. Everything is free form.
Oh.
You're the journalist who has to write. I'm the speaker who just gets up and slings it. There are things in my head.
Of course. You must gather your thoughts.
Right. Once I can get a start, it's like pushing the sled down the hill.
Yeah.
Once you get that first push, then I can go.
And you're reacting, of course, to the faces in the crowd, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a friend of mine who was in opera, we both said the same thing, that our work being on stage for her and being on an altar for me, it's really communication. It is two-way.
Sure. Sure.
You watch people. And if you see somebody questioning something, you know where to go, you know how to do things.
Yeah.
After a while.
Yeah.
After 45 years, if you don't get it right, just get out of there, you know?
Now, I know you keep doing that, but after 45 years of certainly weekly sermons, do you miss that? Is that something to do with the manifestation of this new pulpit you have found on Facebook?
I miss it to an extent. I mean, I keep it up at least once a month. Last couple of months, it's been much more extensive than that. But as I said, this thing called social media, if it's done well, that's how I can preach. When I look at Facebook, there's so much junk on there. Oh, dear God.
Well,
I don't care what somebody had for breakfast.
And self-indulgent junk.
And I don't need a picture of somebody's hot dog. But the only thing I do is, the great thing about to me of Facebook is I can unfriend people.
You
put some of that nonsense. I don't have any right on my screen to have that there.
Right.
And so if I see it again, I got the power. I just hit that boom key and they're gone.
You do have the power. I'm talking this entire hour with Father John Cusick. Do you still call yourself, should I call you Father John Cusick?
You can call me anything you want. You've done that for many
years. That's true. Well, but being a priest is kind of like being a Marine, right? Once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine.
Semper Fi.
Yeah, Semper Fi. We're just going to spend the rest of this hour talking to John Cusick, formerly of Old St. Pat's. Do sometime today, or maybe you're on vacation this week, sometime before the new year. Go look up his writings on Facebook. It's John, J-O-H-N, Cusick, C-U-S-I-C-K. We got a little commercial, then we'll get some news, and we'll continue this, I think, fascinating conversation. Welcome back. This is Rick Hogan filling in for Bill and Wendy for another hour and 25 minutes. I'm spending this entire hour with Father John Cusick, formerly of Old St. Pat's. And you can see and read him, and this is what I'm recommending you do sometime this week, especially if you're off, is to find him on Facebook and read him on Facebook. He is a great writer, but the stuff that he's been writing, he laughs. It's great and self-effacing. The stuff that he's been writing over the last couple of weeks is thought-provoking. It is knowledgeable. It is sensitive. Here is some of what he wrote. This was on December 17th. These are just excerpts. You can read the whole thing. He says, I was fully aware that the practice of religion and regular mass attendance was not a high priority in many of their lives at the time. He's talking about friends and colleagues. But when he would make his midnight mass, which he did for 45 years, he said the midnight mass, the reason people go, he says, the answer is easy. It is part of our Catholic DNA. Even, John, and thank you for coming in. John came in from Lake Geneva this morning. Those of you complaining about, oh, I have to go to the grocery store, consider the fact that Father Cusick came in from Lake Geneva, even though on a train. What do you mean by Catholic DNA? Because midnight mass, sometimes it's held at 8:30, sometimes it's held at 10.
Well, that's what I alluded to in my article, that people who are doing it, particularly people in my profession, they don't understand Catholic DNA. Midnight mass is midnight,
right?
Not 8, not 10:30. And it's the only night of the year you got to welcome people at that hour.
Yeah.
I mean, for one night of the year, come on, fellas. And for me, Rick, because I did midnight mass over here at Quigley, as you know,
sure.
Next to Loyola downtown, and you don't know who's going to show up. You have the searchers and the seekers. You have all different kind of things. And my goal has always been, I want to give them the best hour that I can, spiritually speaking, because they're walking in and I don't know why.
And you don't know, when you would do that, there would always be people you did not know. It wasn't there were some, of course, in the John Cusick fan club.
Yeah, you get that.
Who wouldn't miss it at all, right. And who were devotees. But there were others who you'd never seen before.
No, and nor will I see him again. But I want to make sure that they made a good decision. That's all. I go around throwing seed into the ground. Some of it grows, some of it doesn't. All I can do is take my gift, and I can offer it to other people. That's all.
What is your gift?
My gift is just to try to connect people with something that might be going on inside of their lives, to give them an outlet, maybe a sense of hope, a number of different things. I run into, as you would guess, all types of human beings.
Oh, no question.
With all different kinds of things. And, I remember when I was getting ready to be ordained, I said to myself one day, I'm going to try, if I can, to treat everybody equally. You don't have to know anybody. You know, and after living all those years over here at Old St. Pat's, somebody come up and say, well, now, Father, I'm a friend of... I don't care who you're a friend of.
May I say, thank God.
Yeah, and if somebody needs something... And I have the time to do it, I'll say, sure, I'll be more than happy to do that for you. You need a child baptized? Not a problem. You know, you're looking to get married? We can work that out. One of the great mentors of my life, Father Peter Bowman, may he rest in peace, said, John, between the words yes and no, there's a lot of things in the middle. And I've lived off of that. I want to be a caring human being, and I hope that other people would pass it on. You know,
you write on your fascinating posts over the last couple of weeks. Everyone is equal in the eyes of God. I am the messenger of that. That's
right.
Exactly what you're.
I believe that.
What you're saying.
Right.
You also write that nobody should be alone. See, but here's your level of understanding. You know, a lot of people would say nobody should be alone at Christmas as a kind of blanket statement. You, however, say nobody should be alone at Christmas unless they choose.
Exactly.
To be alone.
Right. And I have a dear friend, and we are in what we call the Only Child Club. And there are many times we both said, I'd rather be alone on Christmas Day.
You put Fiona Cogan in that, you know, that crowd,
then
too.
To put up sometimes. But I have the most loving family now where I look forward to being with them on Christmas. And I think my cousin and her husband, Tom and Madeline, might be listening this morning. So I thank them publicly for opening their home to so many people over the years. But if you choose to be alone, that's fine.
Your parents also opened their home.
To the kids from the orphanage.
Yeah, about that. So that was a very moving story. And I'm telling you people, again, I don't want to overburden John and make his holiday, his week between Christmas and New Year's Eve, burdened by responding to Facebook people. You don't have to friend him. You can just go read him.
Oh, you can friend me, but I'm retired. I'm not working.
Okay, friend him. Go to Facebook, John Cusick, JohnCusick, and you can read this story about how your parents took a couple of kids.
Yeah, I had the privilege for 5 or 6 years of working. It began just as a summer assignment at Angel Guardian Orphanage, Upper Misericordia.
Sure.
It's located
on
Ridge and Devon. And I also continued to work on there 1 or 2 days a week. I would drive in from Mundelein, where the seminary was. And I said to my mom and dad one day, I said, you know, do you think we could call Sister Joette? She was the major domo. And see if there's any kids that maybe not be going someplace on Christmas. Mm. And my mom and dad both said, yeah, we can take them in. That's not a problem. And so I let Sister know. And she said, I think everybody's taken care of, but I'll keep that in mind. Well, by God, Christmas Eve morning, Sister Joette calls. And she said, we've got 2 kids, Tommy and Kathy, who have no place. They'll have to stay here. And I said, I'll drive up and pick them up. Well, Rick, the saddest of things I found out, they were waiting for me in the office. They had their little overnight bags. They were both in grade school, about a year apart in age. Sister called me into her office. And she said, John, I have to tell you something, that their mother showed up early today to pick them up. But by the time they came down, she turned around and left.
Ugh.
She couldn't handle it, you know. And I said, well, Sister, I'm honored to be able to have the opportunity along with my mom and dad. So I got them home, and we went to Christmas Mass. And after Mass, Mother had gone out and got a couple of gifts for them.
Oh.
Well, they went upstairs to their bedrooms and came down each with 2 gifts. And as they were given their gifts, they each gave my dad a gift and my mom a gift. And on the Christmas wrapping, it said, Mom, Dad.
Ugh.
And it's the gifts they bought for their mom and dad, they gave to my mom and dad. And, oh, what else can you say?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You tell that story so
beautifully.
Yeah,
they felt so welcome. You know, and you can't, I'm not going to go after their mother. She wasn't healthy.
Yeah, right. Something
she was
wrong.
Not,
right.
You know, she couldn't handle it. That's why she's got kids at Angel Guardian.
Yeah.
But thank God there are so many volunteers who do these kind of things on a regular basis.
When you do see it, I mean, and you make the point again in your Facebook posts and your preaching on Facebook is what I'm going to call it. You talk about how, yes, you will. If you watch the news, you'll see, oh, people at a food pantry or people at a soup kitchen or people wrapping toys for little kids. The thing that, and you know this too, and you write about this too, is it like happens this time of year and then it's done. You think many people think they've done their part and that's it.
I never go off on people like that, because you never know what has happened in that one experience. Maybe they saw something about the downside of life they've never seen before. Maybe because of that, 2 months later, they write a check for $100. Maybe they find another way to do that in a quiet, non-organized kind of a fashion. I am not out there to judge or trash anybody.
That's my job. Yeah.
Yeah, you're the writer.
Well, I'm the judger too. Yeah.
But I just think the fact that they would even do it once before Christmas. I told a story, and I think it was on Facebook. This kid Danny, who I used to take down to Catholic Charity Soup Line out in the alley, on Randolph behind Des Plaines,
sure.
And we would pour soup for the through Catholic Charities, and there had to be about 150, 200 men. In the dark. Oh, Rick, it was saddest thing.
Before
Oprah
moved
in. And they didn't talk.
Yeah, of course
you know?
Not.
Nobody had a last name. It was Rick and John. It was just, that's how it was. You don't want to know too much. But I remember when I brought these high school kids down from Park Ridge, you know, they're altruistic, white kids from the burbs. And,
sure.
And Deacon Pete called them all together. He said, now, when we open the door, just fill the bowls halfway. Well, they were indignant. What do you mean half? They deserve a full bowl of soup in there. And Pete calmed them down and says, let me tell you why. Many of the men whom you will be serving shake. Mm. And if you give them a half a bowl of soup, the chance of burning their hands lessens. They can always have more. We have soup in abundance. What a lesson. Well, this kid who did it during high school, he came back in his college break, brought Christmas trees down from a Christmas tree lot that was closing, and wired them to the parking meters.
Oh.
So that when these guys, mostly guys, there was about two women, would come for their Christmas dinner, there was a little bit of
Christmas tree.
A little bit of something. And he kept it up. And I wonder, I have no idea where he is today.
If he's doing it somewhere else.
And if he's got kids of his own, and by God, they haven't sought that out.
And Cusick, you make a great, great, great point here. Now, I know me, Rick Hogan, filling in for Bill and Wendy, have been telling you to find John Cusick on Facebook. He is. I think it pops up. He'll pop up. It's a very, very distinguished, handsome man with a mustache. Just go read him. Go read him. We've been having a fascinating conversation about all manner of things. Christmas spirit, why people, that religion is not just a matter of going to church. It's kind of how you lead your life. The world's a cruel place. Another one of your postings recently on Facebook, John, you make a point that the world is a cruel place. And it seems particularly cruel in Chicago these days, does it not?
Yes, very. It just, I've lived here all my life, and I think I've been as upset civically this past week as I've ever been. I had a wonderful talk. One of the great mentors of my life, and we come from the same neighborhood, is Father Mike Flager.
Sure.
And
sure.
We had a wonderful talk last week, 2 weeks ago, and he named, without even having to look at a piece of paper, all the kids he's buried. He just listed them like you're listing the starting lineup for the Cubs.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm tired. Well, if a great cutting-edge guy like Mike Flager is tired, imagine the atmosphere and the temperature in the city. It's tough times.
Why do you, I'm not looking for answers here, but why do you think that is? Why do you think people are more, I think part of it is a lack of communication and a lack of, you know, neighbors don't sit on back porches or front stoops anymore, and you're fearful of what you don't know.
Well, when you live in fear, you hide. You know, I mean, look at the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look at Syria. What do people do? They, you know, you live in fear, you run.
Right.
We do the same thing. I remember I had a gentleman in the class behind me, African-American, and we were born on the same day in history. And I was over at his house one day. He lived at 80th and Prairie. And I'm this innocent white kid from five neighborhoods west of there. But what I never saw before, and this is way, way back, there had to be, I counted, there were five locks on the back door.
Wow.
And it never dawned on me, why would you need five locks? Yeah. I wasn't going to ask.
Right, right.
But fear sets up walls. And that's why I say life is cruel. And I think at times, if I can offer people options and possibilities, if you can't break down the wall, well, then try to find a way to climb over it.
Yeah.
You know, and reach out a hand or do something. I was very much influenced by something Royko wrote,
I've been influenced, yeah.
Royko gave everybody in those days panhandling on the bridges, and there weren't that many then.
Yeah.
He found out their name, and he called each one in his column by name. They weren't a drunk. They weren't a bum. They weren't all the kind of names we derogatorily throw at them. But it would be Kevin. It would be Rick, whatever it is. And he wrote a little bit about them in terms of who they are as human beings.
Yeah.
And then he said at the end, he said, you know, if each one of those people, and they won't, wound up with $100 in their coffee cup, that's still less than 99% of the people who walked by them made that day.
Mm.
What are we trashing people for? Mm. And I'll never forget. And Royko left a tremendous impact on the human story on me.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. That's why I say everybody's equal. Find out who they are.
When I took the kid, there's a tendency to look through people. You look through people who serve you a meal at a restaurant.
Right.
You don't ask their name. You don't care. These are service people. And you certainly look through the increasing number of homeless people, especially in a place like Michigan Avenue. You don't. It's not part of your life. It's not part of your social media network.
A couple of weeks ago, when I was preaching at St. Pat's, I told people, I said, I don't know, you know, what you can put in your pocket. If you got a 20 or a 50, break it down into fives. And I said, if you work downtown, slip somebody a five once in a while. And I said, then stop and look for two things. What was the look in the face of the person whom you gave it to, and what happened to you? We've got to look at it both ways.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And guy called me the next day. He said, I flipped the guy a 20 today. and he was so
surprised. The guy dropped dead of a heart attack.
Well, he was so surprised. Well, then here's my guy, who's, there'll be no tag days for him,
yeah,
was so excited that he did this for somebody else. Mm. There's a woman near where you live. In a wheelchair.
Sure.
She's got no shoes, and she's a mess. So I slipped her 50 the other day. And I said, now, do you have a safe place for this? Because I had it pretty much rolled up.
Sure.
And she spotted it. I roll it so that the 5-0 can, just so she knows. And she looked at me like she just won the world. Mm. You know, and I'm pushing people as I'm walking down Michigan Avenue, and did I feel good? I don't know what I felt, but I felt that I did something.
Yeah.
You know, and then I can hear people say to me, well, how do you know she's not a drunk? How do you know she's not cheating?
You don't know.
I don't care. I don't care. I was given the ability to help somebody else, and I made a choice, and that's what I chose to do. That's all. And that was part of the spirit of the season for me.
And this is also part of the spirit of you, John Cusack. Again, you can't see. You preach sometimes at St. Patrick. We're there on Christmas Day, and it's pretty crowded on Christmas Day at Old St. Pat's. A lot of people in fur coats. He writes a beautiful thing about a woman who had to wait a half hour in line as a lot of so-called VIPs came in the church and got their special seats the one day a year they're in the church. But again, you can find him on Facebook, John Cusick. As I said, it's Cusick. He's gotten you have like 100 new friends already just from the show. But are you going to, John, has this empowered you? I mean, I don't remember previous years where you've written so much and so articulately and not off the top of your head, I might add.
Well, you know, the argument you and I have had over an adult beverage is, I talk and you write, and you're the one telling me, you know, you have to write. I'm getting more comfortable with it.
Good.
And let me tell you why it was always hard. I never thought I had anything to say. I'm serious as a heart attack. And number two, I've had the privilege of, you know, hanging out with you and some of the other writers here at the Trib, Judy Heverdes, Blair Kamen. I mean, great. Writers.
Well, don't let the three of us intimidate you.
Well, God. I mean, you have a command of the language in a written form. I try to do it in a verbal form.
Yeah.
But I'm getting more comfortable.
Good. So, you people can sample. Go to Facebook. Look for John Cusick. He will be, I don't know who the other John Cusicks are. It's with an I. One of them's an actor, but he spells it with an A.
Makes a lot of money.
He does. Yeah, I hope he gives 50s to people. He was in Chirac. Have you seen Chirac?
No, I have no desire.
Okay, I don't blame you. Look for the most distinguished John Cusack. Very nice mustache. He looks like he might play golf every once in a while.
With Mr. Cogan.
How's your guy? You and I, we are America's guests. We try to figure out someone we know who runs a golf course or might be a caddy master who will let us go on before there are any other members around so we can sneak on. John, Merry Christmas.
And to you, Rick. And I hope the New Year's
same here.
Enormously,
pal.
But best of health. That's the, at our age, it's about health.
Same here. You look good, though. You look good, and I'm surviving.
That's what you want in the casket. When they walk up, they want to say, he looks good.
That's what I want. That's what I want. I'm not sure I'm going to have a casket, but that's a matter for another discussion. We'll take a little commercial break. Then you'll get some news, and then I'm having in here another guy for an hour, Rich Labriola, who's had a fascinating life, who's going to meet John Cusack, who's going to invite John Cusack to his restaurants. And that'll be that. We'll be right back.
Many minds in circulation.
Yeah.
Believing in reincarnation.
Yeah.
In me you see one who doesn't agree. Challenging possible affronts.
Yes, yes.
I believe I'll only live once.
Get up here.
And I want to make the most of it. If there's a party, I want to be the host of it. If there's a haunted house, I want to be the ghost of it. If I'm in town, I want to be the toast of it.
That, ladies and gentlemen, an old song. Danny Kaye singing a song called One Life to Live, which is a very upbeat song as you're facing the new year. I'm Rick Hogan, filling in for Bill and Wendy, and I'm doing the unusual, the long-form interview. I had Father John Cusack in here from 10 to 11, and now it is my pleasure to welcome Rich Labriola. Rich, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
When's the last time you were in confession? Don't tell me. Don't tell me.
That's all I could think about on the way down now listening was...
was, oh my God, he's going to make me go to confession on the radio.
I did remember last time I was on confession was when I got married, and I'm now divorced, so it's a long time ago.
Okay, good. I hope the marriage was sort of okay for most of the time.
I think it worked out well for both now.
Good. I met Rich when I was eating at a new restaurant opened about a year ago. It was last year. Called Labriola, which is in the 530. It's on Grand Avenue in the sort of where you. I don't even know where the address is.
It's 535 North Michigan, but it's on the promenade kind of on the side.
So you see it. If you're walking north on Michigan Avenue, you can see it on the side. And I loved it. I fell in love with the place. There are a lot of nice restaurants around here. And one day some guy comes over and says, hey, are you enjoying your meal? And I say, yeah. And he goes, I say, you don't look like a waiter. He goes, well, I own the place. And we started talking. Your background, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Blue Island, south suburbs.
What'd your parents do?
My dad owned a pizza business, a very small pizza business. My mom was a homemaker.
By pizza business, you own a pizza restaurant, or did he make...
Very small carry-out delivery, some seating, but nothing, couldn't even compare it to something that's around now. When you sat down, when you ate there... You got a pizza, really fast cardboard circle, and you got a can of Pepsi out of this Coke machine.
Yeah, was it a good pizza parlor?
It was great. I mean, people who lived in Calumet Park, he sold it in 1978. You know, he found someone who used to buy that pizza. Most of them will tell you they haven't found one like that since.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the name of the place?
Danny's Pizza.
Danny's Pizza? That's a perfect name for a pizza joint. That's perfect. I assume your dad was Danny?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Was there any... You must have worked there as a kid.
I worked there from when I was about 9 years old.
Doing what?
Making pizza.
And did that tell you you didn't want to be in the pizza-making business?
It actually told me that this is no way to live. because it was night work. You know, I would go in. It was kind of it's funny. It's a rite of passage in our family that... At a certain age, you go to work. And it wasn't like someone dragged you to work. It was like, I can't wait to go to work.
Really?
I think it was before I started working there, I used to have this ploy, so I thought, that I would hide my dad's car before he left for work around 3 o'clock every 3:30 every day. It was only a 5-minute ride, but and it was before I could tell time, so I would have to guess. I would guess on it, and so I would hide in the back seat of the car and wait. Because once he got to work with me there, he had no choice but to let me stay. And I never timed it right. And by the time I could tell time, then I would go in the front seat. So that was interesting because I always wanted to go.
You have brothers and sisters?
I'm the youngest of four.
And they all worked in the business.
They all worked too, yes.
Did he want you to, was there ever any, hey, you'll take over my business for me?
No, not that I can remember. It was always, do what you want. He did that. I think, he came back from World War II, had a few jobs, and decided to go in that business. I don't remember what caused him to decide to go into it.
Were his parents in the food business?
No. I mean, my grandparents, I came from Italy in the early 1900s. Had, you know, I think my grandfather worked for a gas company or something like that.
So you're a teenager and you're still working there? Where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school at the Eisenhower High School in Blue Island.
Know it well. What do you want to do then?
You know, I
did
really...
the kids all love you because your dad owned Danny's Pizza?
Well, you know, he sold it. You know, I went a year after, so so there really wasn't much. You know, in high school, I've always had two jobs from the time I was 16 till I opened the wholesale bakery. I always had two jobs because, you know, I'd like to make money. I like to spend
it. Well, but it's
it.
Also, I mean, your parents seem to have a pretty decent work ethic here. I mean, it was every day.
Yes.
It was a small family-owned business, so.
Yeah, my mother worked there when she could.
So you're in high school. What do you want to do when you're in high school?
You
want to make pizza. That's the one.
Well, I didn't want to. I didn't think I wanted to because, you know, working there at that age, just, I like doing it.
Yeah.
I didn't think I wanted to work at night.
It wasn't by the way you describe it, Rich Labriola, it wasn't by any stretch. You wouldn't call it a restaurant, would you?
No. I mean, it was, and that's not to degrade it. It was a great place.
Kind of
a
storefront.
There was no servers. There was, you know, probably 30 seats.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it was such a small place in Kymet Park that when he did 100 pizzas on a Friday night, it was like a party. You know, the greatest thing that I remember, there's two things that are really memorable to me.
Yeah.
Are when I first started making pizzas, and I tell this story a lot, which means I'm getting old.
You're not old.
he would come by, and this is, you know, this is a long time ago, so I hope I remember the story well. He would come by, you know, first couple times, and he would maneuver the cheese around, you know. And I'd look at him, and I'm like, you know, this looks like what you were doing, you know, 9 or 10 years old. And it went on for a little while, of course, and a couple times I complained to my mom, who was my protector.
Of course.
And then she yelled at him, and then it stopped for a little bit. And then it would come back. And then, you know, so I was determined that if they looked good enough, he wouldn't touch them. And eventually that's what happened, you know.
Interesting. Was, you know, so he was kind of, you would call him an artist?
He was an artist. Yeah. He was a sign painter, and he did some other stuff too. So he kind of was an artist.
Oh, interesting.
So he did that on the side. I really believe that may have been more his passion than anything, which I – he gave none of that to me. I draw stick figures.
Yeah, wait a minute. But the restaurant business, I think, has gotten more – in your lifetime, the restaurant business has gotten more and more creative that restaurants are not just places to eat. When you got out of high school, what did you want to do?
You still didn't know. I, like everybody. Yeah, I didn't. I knew I didn't want to go to college. I think just because I didn't know, all my friends were going to college. All my friends that I consider close friends had the same work ethic that I did.
Yeah,
and none of them really went away to college, and it wasn't for no reason.
Well, isn't it because? And I've known people like that too. That you work all during high school. And if you're not captured by the desire to be a doctor or a lawyer or something, it's like, well, now I'm going to go get a job and make money and live on my own, get a girlfriend and have babies and stuff.
Yeah, there's always the desire to be successful.
Yeah,
But, you know, when I was like 16 or 18, I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what does successful mean.
Your father retired from the restaurant by then?
Yeah, because he was when he sold it in 1978, he worked a few more years, then he retired.
Yeah.
And, when I was actually, I forgot this. When I was 19 years old, myself and my brother and my brother-in-law bought a pizza business in Elsip that lasted a couple years. I think that's where my desire to do high quality came from, because we weren't doing high quality, because the pizza restaurant we bought, which is small carryout, had a certain name and a certain recipe that we continued on with that I didn't want to continue on with because we had so much better recipe to use, but we really never did that.
Wow.
So we ended up selling
it. So all of a sudden, at what point do you decide for yourself, I think I want to, it seems like a big leap. You knew what a crust was, but how do you say to yourself, I think I'm going to start a bread company.
I think here's what happens to start a successful bread company. One is my uncle brought me some bread from a bakery up in Elmwood Park.
Okay.
My mom used to cook for my uncle. His wife didn't cook much. She cooked for him when he had parties. And he came by. He brought a loaf of bread. First, I thought the bread was stale. Just it had a hard crust. And this is probably when I was about 27. And so I asked him where he got it. And, of course, being, you know, my uncle, he had to control this. So he didn't tell me. He said, I'll get you some more. So long story short, I started to talk to the person who owned the bakery. The bakery is actually Casa Nostra Bakery in Elmwood Park.
That's the name of it?
That was the name of it.
Cosa Nostra Bakery.
Yes.
Fascinating name.
Not Cosa, Casa.
Yeah, okay, yeah, but close enough.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And you started talking to him and what?
I wanted to distribute bread in the south suburbs because nobody did that. Only the big players were in the south suburbs. None of the smaller players that were of good quality were not in the south suburbs.
Oh, so you discovered this Elmwood Park place. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it came from my uncle, really. He just brought this bread. It literally, I had no idea about the baking business, didn't know how to bake, didn't know how to do anything.
We got to take a little break. We're having a fascinating conversation with Rich Labriola. We have gotten through high school. He's in his 20s now. He used to make pizza, but he didn't. He used to hide in his dad's car before he could tell time. And now he's decided that bread is going to be his future. We'll continue this conversation. He's on all the way till noon. And this is Rick Kogan filling in for Bill and Wendy. Welcome back. Rick Hogan filling in for Bill and Wendy, as I will tomorrow, exploring the nature of the long-form interview, meaning an hour interview with one person. That person this hour is Rich Labriola. And if you've been listening, we have followed him from Danny's Pizza, run by his dad, into having his own pizza joint, into getting a piece of bread that had been brought to his uncle from a bakery in Elmwood Park and saying, hey, basically, Rich, hey, why can't we get this bread around here? He's in the south suburbs. That basically is it, right?
That is it. And so, you know, I went to talk to the owner, he didn't have any distribution in the south suburbs because he was very small. So we talked about it for a few months, and there was one thing kind of in the way was that I was working at the time.
What were you doing?
I was a meter reader for Commonwealth Edison.
Okay.
I mean,
you could do door-to-door then. Well, that would be a good way.
That would not be a bad idea.
Sell the bread.
And, you know, at the time, I consider myself someone who always tells the truth.
Yeah.
At the time, I had fabricated why I left Commonwealth Edison for a little while, which was they no longer needed my services. meaning they fired me.
Yeah.
So they justifiably fired me. I was not the best employee at the time. And so,
well, you know, the thing is, if you couldn't tell time when you were little, now you couldn't read the meter correctly.
That could have been the problem.
This guy, something's wrong with this guy. You can't even read the meter right.
Exactly.
So you got fired, and you have, which is in a way, I'm sure you've known a lot of people. Sometimes when people get fired, a new door opens.
Yes. So at the time I got fired, you know, it was devastating because I had wanted that job forever. Maybe it was just lack of interest in the job, but I was just not the exemplary employee, you know. And it's not an easy – meter reading is a tough job. I think it's changing now because it's all automatic. But it's a lot of jumping fences. It's a lot of dogs. It's a lot of neighborhoods.
It's a lot of going in basements. I understand. I remember those days.
But, you know, in the end, they decided to part ways with me. And so I had two choices at the time. Actually, I can remember this clearly was – my brother, who was a state employee, had gotten me into an interview with the tollway department.
Yeah,
and it was sitting in an office all day long for $9 an hour.
Okay,
or it was I'm going to try this bread distributing thing and see what happens. So I just couldn't bring myself to the job at sitting in an office.
Yeah, of course.
So I gave it a try. To do my own bread. So I talked to the owner of the bakery. I started out delivering samples in my car.
To restaurants or to grocery
stores? Restaurants, country clubs, everything.
Oh,
so I had this grand plan. I mean, I was 27, and this grand plan was that as soon as I think I can get $1,000 a week in business, I'll flip the switch and start and go in business. So that took me a couple months out of my it was a 1985 and a half Ford Escort. It was a half year model. It had different headlights, and I think it was 116 horsepower, four cylinders.
Did people receive the bread well? Obviously,
they did, because it was something different.
Yeah,
I mean, I hadn't honed my sales skills at the time. I just was kind of.
Hi, do you want some bread?
Exactly. Yeah. I knew nothing about the bread. I wasn't a baker, so it took a while, and so one day, I think it was in July of 1990, I just decided that, give somebody a notice. And so I thought I had $1,000 a week. So I went back to everybody and said, hey, I'm starting in 2 weeks. What do you think? Some chefs, we're not sure yet, this and that. So in reality, I had $300 a week.
Yeah.
And, to start out at $300 a week was...
To start a company, Well, it's kind of like, Steve Jobs in a garage, man. I mean, you haven't become Apple yet, but it's a leap. You had faith in this thing you were doing, didn't you?
I did, because I believed... I can only sell a product that I believe in. And that's why I always have to have a great product no matter what I do, because I have to believe in it. If I don't believe in it, then I can't rightfully try to talk you into consuming it.
Wow.
So our first – in reality, the good thing is that at $300 a week, you can fit that in the back of a 1985 and a half Ford Escort.
Yes, right.
That was the good thing. So because it's only $50 a day.
Yeah.
Our first customer, I think up until today, is still a bakery customer, because I've since sold the bakery, is Ridge Country Club in Beverly.
Know it well.
It's our very first customer.
Wow.
So I started very small like that.
You're basically, at that point, you're just a distributor for this bakery in Elmwood Park.
Yeah, I would drive up to Belmont and Harlem every day and drive back down.
Fill up the 85 and a half car.
Yeah, until it got too big. When it got to $2,000 a week, then we had a problem. Now I needed a truck.
So that became the foundation for you creating La Briola Bakery.
Yes, because the... distributorship was a very good business, and I always had a very good relationship with the owner, but I didn't see where the future would be for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he ever would have done anything, to hurt that business, but
yeah.
I only had one source for this. It was his source, and I wasn't comfortable with that.
Wow.
So it took me 2.5 years to devise my bakery plan, which started in December 8th of 1993 is when I opened the bakery.
You must have done some kind of studying before opening the bakery.
I didn't learn how to make bread at that time because, I hired some bakers. And, by that time, we had $3,000 a week in business 3 years later. So it was still not a great number.
Yeah.
But I was making good money at it because I was doing everything.
You were it, yeah.
And so we started out. And for a few years, we did good. But then one time, I'm not even sure how it came about, is I learned about artisanal breads, which are sourdoughs, baguettes,
right.
All long fermentations.
I guess.
I took a couple classes in San Francisco, and once I learned how to make a sourdough bread, I had toyed with it, but once I really knew how to do it, all the lights came flashing on of what I thought I was good at.
Wow. That business started in 1993. And obviously was a terribly successful business. You sold it. This is timing out perfectly. I'm keeping you for another half hour, Rich LaBriola. You sell the business 20 years later, right?
Two and a half years ago. At that point in time when we were doing it, it doesn't sound like a lot of sales, but for the type of breads we did, it was a lot. The sales were about $35 million.
Wow. There, ladies and gentlemen.
Sales of the bakery, not what I sold.
Is a success story. Yeah. There, ladies and gentlemen, is a success story. I'm keeping Rich for the entire hour. I'll play you one song when I let him go. But I'm talking to restaurateur now, Rich LaBriola, and his story in this half hour is really it's kind of like the American dream story. His grandparents were immigrants. They came here. His father owned a pizza joint. And he sold had a piece of bread, thought it was really good. And the next thing you know, it's $35 million sale. We'll get a little commercial in, then you get some news, and Rich and I will keep talking. Hey there, Rick Kogan filling in for Bill and Wendy. A great, nice crowd. Kevin Richter's a great producer. Ben Cortez, engineering, and I go way, way back, and it's always great to be with him, too. And he's teaching the young, intelligent Emily Rush how to run a radio station. Emily will leave here at noon going, God, that's so easy. I should have my own radio show. I'm spending this whole hour with Rich Labriola, who is a fascinating guy, a born entrepreneur, who has just been telling us how he, you know, used to hang around his dad's pizza joint named Danny's Pizza in Calumet Park, and how he went to high school in Blue Island, and then how he was a meter reader, and then he ate a piece of bread and fell in love with the bread, started distributing the bread, which was made in Elmwood Park, started his own bakery called Labriola, and then sold that bakery a few years ago. You had started, though, Rich, you had started your first restaurant, hadn't you, by then?
Yes, the first restaurant was in Oak Brook in 2008.
All right, what the restaurant business, which you know better than anybody, but I've known for covering it for all these years, is one of the toughest businesses. You know, you'd have an easier time, you know, selling, being a marijuana distributor. It's a tough business. Why'd you decide to get in it?
The first restaurant was really a way to promote our brand because people didn't know where to go buy the bread. So we opened a restaurant and said, "This, you know, this is a showcase for our bread." It had great food also, because again, I go back to, if I'm going to sell you on something, it's got to be great.
You've got the great restaurateur philosophy. That's really true. Was it an immediate hit in Oak Brook?
It wasn't. It took a few months, and people, you know, just started to find it, and it was something different at the time, which isn't so different now, because
how?
You had freshly prepared food. Like we make our own salad dressings, our own sauces. We pat our own burgers. Obviously, the bread comes from Labriola. But you didn't have a waiter. You had number service, similar to a bakery cafe. I won't use names.
Yeah.
But much better service, much better quality food, because there's only one.
Yeah.
It was really... And people thought that it was great that in 2008 a restaurant like that could thrive. But going back and looking at it, it thrived because it was great. But it also, people didn't have the money to go out at full service, so they came to me and got the same quality of food without a waiter.
That's interesting. Did you know that going? You couldn't have known.
I didn't know that Oak Brook needed something like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that was kind of a
where is it in Oak trend. Brook? Oak Brook's a strange. First of all, why Oak Brook?
You know, I had been looking for spots for a few years. Okay. I drove by this spot in the Oak Brook Promenade, and I saw it available. Honestly, I didn't think we'd be able to afford the rent, but we just kept going. I said, you know, every year in January, I say I'm going to open a cafe. I go for a few months. I get caught up in another business, and I stop.
Yeah.
This time, I'm just going to go through the process and see what happens. So we went through the process. Turned out that it wasn't something that we couldn't afford. So we developed a menu. You know, people thought it was only pastry and coffee. It was much more. I mean,
the buzz on that place was pretty good. Knowledgeable people like Kathy Murray, when this place opened on Michigan Avenue, said, oh my God, that's the place from Oak Brook. So the word of mouth on the original place is pretty good. What would make you, Rich Labriola, and you seem like a very smart guy, decide to make the leap? It's a big leap from Oak Brook to Michigan Avenue, is it not?
It's a huge leap. It's a huge leap. And, you know, most people will tell you not to do it. It's a lot of work. It still is
a lot of rent.
It's a lot of rent. But there's only one Michigan Avenue in Chicago. I always feel that when you're in the suburbs, and we're going through this now with a new restaurant we opened, is that when you have something great, it's a little, the image is a little bit diminished because you're not in the city.
Yeah.
So yeah, what we want to do is bring this experience and more to the city. That was the whole idea.
The restaurant, the configuration and the sort of philosophy behind your restaurant in the 535 building on the north side of the building, you can see it if you're walking north on Michigan Avenue at Grand. It is part fine dining. Your dining room is the rival of any I can tell you in
yes.
Chicago.
Yes.
It is a cool bar area with booths, And then it is kind of a, I don't know, what do you call it, a cafe?
It's a cafe.
It's three restaurants in one,
yes,
right?
Yes, and the components, you know, the cafe is meant to mirror Oak Brook. And the restaurant is something new for us, the full-service restaurant. But I think that's part of the future of where the restaurant company that I own wants to go. There's a lot of different ways to go for us. I think if you look at the restaurants we're doing and the things we're doing, you might say I don't understand what the philosophy is. But when it comes from the mind and the heart of a baker, then you understand.
Yeah.
Because yeah. The cafe is based on, you know, we have pizza at the cafe. We do some of our own breads there. The restaurant downtown here, we bake our own bread at night. The cafe has always been bread-related. And then we have Stan's Donuts, which I started a couple
yeah,
of years
the way,
ago.
This is the thing. Stan's Donuts are like the hippest meal in Chicago now. I guarantee yes. you, for New Year's morning with all these hungover 20-somethings, that's going to be the breakfast of champions and breakfast of choice. And Emily Rush is going to have Stan's Donuts for breakfast. How did you find Stan's Donuts? This is how we met. You told me this.
Yes.
I'm saying, yes. You said, how's everything? I said, it's fine. What do you do? I own this place. Have you had one of our donuts? And I go, well, I usually don't eat donuts at lunch, but yes, I'll have a donut. Tell the story, because Stan's Donuts are beyond hip, and we'll talk how. But
yeah,
how did that happen?
So Stan's Donuts, we always try to – there's always somebody when you ask your opinions of people, what do you think of this? And most people say, I don't do it, because that's the easiest thing to do is say, I don't do it. You know, I've heard that since since I opened the bakery, don't do it. And you know, eventually somebody might be right, but they haven't been yet. So,
thank God.
So I talked to Stan Berman is in Westwood, California. He's 86 years old. He's had the same donut shop in the same spot for 50 years now. So I saw him on the Travel Channel one time about 8 years ago, called him up, and not knowing what this place was, it's smaller than his studio.
Yeah.
And he answers the phone because the phone, now that when I went there, it reminded me of my dad, really.
I was just going to say that.
So there's a phone on the wall. It's on a piece of wood. It's one of those old slimline phones.
Yeah.
And that's the only phone he's ever had. And it's the phone my dad used to have. And it's just such a reminder of why I'm connected to him as a baker. And he reminds me of my dad. So we talked for a few years. And then we kind of lost touch a little bit. And then right around the time that
you talked to him a bit, but you were obviously maybe looking for the same kind of deal you made with the bakery in Elmwood Park. Hey, can I distribute your donuts in Chicago or something like that?
Open shops, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so it's just that I was busy still growing the baking company. And so we let it go for a few years. And right around the time the donut shops were opening in Chicago, you know, I thought this might be a good idea. Well, it was a good idea because there was three or four people who beat me to the punch. But my idea was a donut and coffee shop because I've lived in Chicago my whole life, and I don't know of there is no donut coffee shop culture in Chicago other than the big guy like Dunkin' Donuts. When I was a kid, that was a donut coffee shop. It's not so much anymore, not to disparage it.
Right.
But there's great bakeries who have good donuts, and there's bigger donut shops, but there's not a donut coffee shop culture. I can't think of one. I've looked around. There isn't. And so, same thing. People are like, there's a lot of donut shops in Chicago. Don't bother. And my thing was that this is a different thing. This is a donut and coffee shop. There's real seats in it. We're not going to run out of donuts because we're a coffee shop. It's going to stay open. So we opened in February of 2014 at Damon and North Avenue.
Yeah. How many are there now?
We are opening our fourth on January 16th at Roosevelt and State.
Wow. It has been, Stanson, there's another one over here on Huron or Franklin or someplace.
Erie and Fairbanks.
And you sell them at
Labriola
too.
At 535.
Are you surprised by the success of Stan's?
You love
the donuts.
Well, it brings the baker out in me. You know, I'm surprised, but I'm not. You would like to think that as much work as I put into, because I took what Stan does and I modified it as myself as a baker. I mean, our yeast raised donut, if you saw the work that goes into it, it gets mixed like a bread dough. There's a special way we mix it. It gets put in the retarder overnight. It's got 24 hours of rest before we even cut it. You know, it's all those things going into this little yeast raised donut. So, in that respect, I realize it's a great product. So I'm not surprised, but I am surprised that, you know, we came in last, so to speak, on the donut shops. But I believe that
that's crazy.
We definitely put our best foot forward. And, you know, I'm not saying that we're the best donut shop in Chicago, but
I think what will tell is the amount you ring up in cash register money. At the
In that respect, I think we're the best.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, man, because I literally sometimes go to La Briola, have lunch, and then, like, have a donut for dessert like I'm a 12-year-old or something. We'll continue on with Rich La Briola talking about his restaurants, his Stan's Donuts, his fascinating, fascinating career. This is Rick Cogan filling in for Bill and Wendy for a few more minutes. I'll be here tomorrow. Also, I'm exploring the concept of the long-form interview. I did an hour with John Cusick, and now I've had a delightful and revelatory time talking to restaurateur Rich La Briola about his life and his upbringing and his... You don't want to call what you do now. It's not an empire, is it, Rich? It's a reflection of your passion, isn't it? The two restaurants and the Stan's Donuts, and more restaurants to come.
Yes, I wouldn't call it an empire. It's what we like to do. I mean, it's the third restaurant we just opened in September, actually.
Where's that?
That's in Oak Brook also. It's called Pizza Barra. So it's pizza in small plates.
Interesting.
It's a unique concept because it's a small plate has been a big deal the last 10 years.
No question.
Shareable plates. And we do different styles of pizza. We do an artisanal pizza in a coal-fired oven. We do a pan pizza and a Chicago thin crust. And actually, Steve Dolinsky, the Hungry Hound, had ordered the pan pizza,
good
the number
guy.
One pizza in the suburbs.
Really?
And the artisanal pizza, the number one pizza overall.
In the world. In the world. The number one pizza in the world. Stan's Donuts are the number one donut in the world.
So I partnered up with Chris Macchia, who's a chef who used to be at Coco Pazzo.
He's
a great, great chef. I worked on the dough, which it all goes back to dough for me. Everything goes back to dough.
As well it should.
Yes.
As well
and
it should.
We're also going to add to our restaurant at 535 North Michigan these styles of pizzas sometime in January. So you will be able to get the Pizza Bar experience at 535 North Michigan, along with La Stanza and our bar and our cafe. You'll have these great pizzas
This is great. Now I can go on a diet next year of nothing but pizza and donuts.
We'll deliver you a pizza also.
Pizza and donuts, and you'll deliver from that place?
Oh, yeah.
Is that true?
Definitely.
What area?
I don't have the exact date yet.
Or the exact area.
Yeah.
That's my new diet for 2016. Pizza, donuts, and bourbon. So here's to a healthy 2016. Rich, when you look back, I mean, when you're, you know, falling asleep or get up in the middle of the night or not, I know you're very busy. Do you sometimes, I find the ride you are on and the ride you were taking really pretty amazing. It's not so much a matter of luck or being in the right place at the right time, but it's sort of a manifestation of your passion.
You know, I was thinking about this yesterday that, when people say right place, right time, or the harder you work, the luckier you get, it's really true because, and what's meant by that is some of my greatest achievements in this business have been by chance, including today. I mean, honestly, if I was not there at the restaurant, I might not be here. But I was there working. And I remember the first day I went into
Being on this radio show is not going to loft you to the level of success of starting La Briola Bakery meeting Stan.
It's all little components.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
But, you know, I can remember the day, like now La Briola Baking is known for pretzel bread. Well, there was a time 15 years ago I didn't even want to make pretzel bread. But, I'll try to shorten the story, but there's a Radisson Hotel in Maryville, Indiana. And I was trying to get the business. This is over 15 years ago. And I kept pounding the door. One day I walked in when the new chef walked in, and we got some business from that. Later on, that chef went to McCormick Place, wanted me to do pretzel bread, and we did it. And then pretzel bread expanded to now all the way to Costco.
Wow.
So just that little keep pushing the door in is how we got there.
One thing you callers can do, if you have a moment, is to go to labriolacafe.com. You'll learn about the restaurant. You will learn about where you can buy the bread. The bakery is still, you don't own it, but...
I don't own it. The bread is a little bit hard to come by now.
Is it?
Yes.
Is it?
Yes. this is an unofficial thing, but since I don't own the bakery, they can't get mad at me. Trader Joe's carries Labriola breads.
Oh, okay. Trader Joe's. Trader
Joe's.
Great
partner with Labriola, as is Costco for the pretzel bread.
Well, I just think you've had the most fascinating career, Rich Labriola, and I think it's only going to get better. It is not one of these, you know, Chicago is known, and I don't know if it troubles you or makes you feel proud, as, you know, this incredibly hip restaurant town with places like Alinea, and you cannot find food made of foam at Labriola, but I think you probably respect all those highfalutin chefs too, don't you?
Of course. I mean, as long as you're doing what you love to do, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, you have to. If you don't love to do it, then you're just wasting a lot of time for everybody, because this business is way too hard if you don't love it.
Yeah.
And the reason why I think I gravitated towards it from the bakery was, bakery business is a little bit tougher in a lot of ways because you're 24/7. The place never closes. Restaurant business, you know, has its own set of challenges. In the bakery business, when I wanted to go grow, I got my car and delivered samples and grew it that way.
Yeah.
And that's also basically how I learned the restaurant business. Is I had the unique opportunity to talk to hundreds of restaurateurs on how they were successful. You know, nobody has that experience
good
to give, because I go in, I get to talk to Steve Lombardo, I get to talk to Hugo, I get to talk to Phil Stefani, Alex Dane. I get to talk to all those guys because I'm talking about bread, but I'm also listening to what they do successfully. And that's part of how we built our business, on people like that, and what, you know, what they say is, this is how we're successful.
On the foundation, it's kind of like Clint Eastwood talking to every movie director he ever worked
with, exactly.
And now he's a great director.
Exactly.
So you're the Clint Eastwood of restaurants. That's what I'm going to call you from now.
Well, thank you.
That is Rich. Well, continued success. Happy New Year and all that jazz. Go to LabriolaCafe.com. You'll get a little bit of the backstory, but if you've been listening for the last 55 minutes, you've got a great deal of the backstory. And I do know that Rich works really hard. I mean, I was at the restaurant a few days ago and we just waved to each other. And I see people coming in and Rich is having a conversation, a business meeting of some sort, and he's up and he's greeting these people and he's leading them to a table. It reminds me of some of the great old restaurateurs like Eli Shulman and Arnie Morton. Are your parents still alive?
No.
Did they see your success?
No.
They never got a chance? No. That's too bad. I think your parents would be really, really proud of you.
I agree.
I'm going to end this this segment with a song that I think will give you some hope for the new year. It's The Way You Should Live. And if you've just been listening to Rich Labriola for the last hour, I hope he inspires you to follow your passion. Follow your passion and hope for good luck.
There are many minds in circulation.
Yeah!
Believing in reincarnation.
Yeah!
In me you see one who doesn't agree. Challenging possible affronts.
Yes, yes!
I believe I'll only live once.
Yeah, yeah!
And I want to make the most of it. If there's a party, I want to be the host of it. If there's a haunted house, I want to be the ghost of it. If I'm in town, I want to be the toast of it. I say to me every morning, you've only one life to live. So I be done in, let's let the sun in, and gloom can jump in the rear. No use to beat on the door drum. Let's be imaginative. Each day is numbered, no good when slumbered, with only one life to live. Why let the goblins upset you? One smile and see how they run. And what does worrying net you? Nothing, nothing is to have fun. All this may sound kind of hackneyed, but it's the best I can give. Soon comes December, so please remember, you've only one life to live. Just one life to live. I say to me every morning,
you hear from the motto,
you've only one life.